The Pilgrims were able to come over on the Mayflower because of some financial backers in England. Now, one of the stipulations of these backers was that in the New World, they were to hold all things in common. Well, this led to a type of socialism that the Pilgrims were saddled with. What were the results? Well, they were disastrous, as socialism always is. Always. John Eisenman is a law professor. He's the author of the book Christianity and the Constitution. John Eisenman serves on the board of the Plymouth Rock Foundation, which seeks to educate people on the true legacy of the Pilgrims who founded Plymouth in 1620 and really set a very positive tone for what would become, eventually, the United States of America. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point. And, John, we welcome you back to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Jerry. And I know you've always had a very special interest in the Pilgrims, and you're on the board of on the Council of Advisors of our Plymouth Rock Foundation. So I'm just glad you're willing to convey this message to your people.
Sure. Okay, so the London adventurers, the backers of the Pilgrim's Voyage of the Mayflower, tell us about this stipulation that, okay, all things have to be held in common. Did they think, oh, this is going to lead to greater profits or something?
That was the thought of the merchant adventurers. You know, they weren't necessarily in support of the Pilgrim cause. They were out to make some money. And we call them adventurers because they're using venture capital. But they were willing to finance the Pilgrim's voyage and the expenses that it would take to set up a colony, with the idea that that colony would send back crops and furs and other products that they could produce there, and that they would make a profit out of this new colony. But then at the very last, just shortly before the Pilgrims were to leave, they put this stipulation on them that you've got to have all things in common instead of private homes and private plots of land and so on, because if they had all things in common, then instead of profiting themselves, they'd be sending the profits back to the merchant adventurers. The Pilgrims did not like this. They didn't want it at all. But they had to do it because it had been a condition imposed right at the very last, and the financial support would be pulled out from under them, and they wouldn't be able to even leave that year if they didn't agree to it. So they reluctantly agreed, but there was a clause that if the common course and condition made it necessary, they could change it. Well, it led to a disaster. As Bradford says in his History of Plymouth Plantation, some men would not go out to work because they wouldn't profit from it. They saw others who were being indolent, and so why should I work hard if I have to share equally with the ones who are being indolent? I'll be indolent too. And so it simply didn't work. Socialism never works. You know, the really sad thing is that the voters of New York City didn't read Bradford's History of Plymouth Plantation before they elected this Mondani character. If they had, they might have known that what Mondani is proposing is going to be a disaster for them, just like it was a disaster for the Pilgrims, like it was a disaster for the Jamestown settlers before them, and as it has been a disaster everywhere it was tried.
Is the phrase merchant adventurers or merchant venturers? In other words, is there an AD?
The phrase is merchant ad.
Okay.
They call them the merchant adventurers, but
okay,
it's because they engaged in venture capital. They wanted to do so from the safety of their homes and offices in London.
I see. Okay, so let's go back to Plymouth. The Pilgrims land in Plymouth in 1620, and they are able to plant their crops after that disastrous winter where half their number died and so forth. And they did have a modest harvest, which they celebrated in thanksgiving to God in the fall of 1621. How long did this socialistic scheme that was imposed on them, how long did it go on in Plymouth?
It went on longer than they wanted to, but it went on until 1623. At that time, Bradford and the other leaders of the colony just said, this is producing disaster. Our clause that allows us to change the common course and condition, we can change it, and we have to, or we are not going to survive. And so they did change it, and Bradford records in Plymouth Plantation that after that, women would go willingly into the fields, taking their children with them, and he says after that, there was no scarcity of provisions. The thing is about free enterprise, and you know, we hear this word capitalism, and it seems like a lot of people, especially young people, have a negative impression of capitalism because they've been indoctrinated that way in our public schools, but that if they talk about free market or free enterprise rather than capitalism, I think you find the perception will improve somewhat. But the reason socialism doesn't work is it is inconsistent with the law of God, which commands private property and freedom of exchange, and it is inconsistent with the nature of man. Man's by nature to be selfish, self-interested. He'll work hard in order to make a profit for himself and perhaps work hard to support those he loves, his family. But as far as working hard to support the commune or the village or the workers' paradise, well, a fiery speech from the commissar out to the commune might fire up the workers for maybe half of an afternoon, but it's not going to get them to produce over the long run. For that, you need the profit motive that free enterprise supplies. That's simply the biblical concept of the law of nature, and we see it every day in the way people work.
Now, I understand in 1623 when Bradford said, okay, no more
common course and condition was the term.
Common course and condition. In other words, no more socialism here. We'll have private property. He even said something like, well, we almost thought we were wiser than God to you know, buy into this scheme from Plato.
And it's interesting, he refers to Plato's Republic, where Plato talks about this communal experiment and so on. And the point is that Bradford was a self-educated man, but he was a very well self-educated man. He was an orphan, that his mother, or his father died when he was an infant. His mother died when I believe he was 8. He was basically, well, he was sickly. And because he was sickly, instead of going out to the farm and working like he really wanted to, he had to spend his time inside reading the Bible and reading books and studying and becoming a very learned man. And yes, he not only knew the Bible and knew Greek and Hebrew, but he knew the classics as well, and he'd read Plato, and he knew where Plato was wrong.
And that would certainly include this area. So then, how did Bradford say, okay, no more? What did he do then in Plymouth?
Well, they provided for private ownership of homes and so on. Each person had owned their own home after that. They provided further that each person would have a set number of acres as their own plot of land, and that they would have to be taxed on it because they still had to pay off their debts to the merchant adventurers, and they were able to pay it off much better this way than they would have been under the communist experiment. If they'd used the communist experiment, the merchant adventurers would have lost their shirts just like everybody else. But so they had the profit motive applied there, and not only that, but the pilgrims had a remarkable system of commerce. They established trading posts up in New Hampshire for furs, and they found that beaver furs were probably the best up there, and so they established trading posts up there to trade with the natives there for good furs and other things like that, and they had quite a commercial network that they established. In other words, they became very astute economists, free enterprise economists.
And what's interesting, too, is they paid for their land to the Indians at a price that the Indians agreed, and it was a fair price. And Dr. Paul Jaley, who's also, you know, he's the leader of the Plymouth Rock Foundation, for which you serve on the board as well as a key leader. But Jaley has noted that in Plymouth itself, to this day, we have the deeds, records of the pilgrims paying for this land that the Indians approved, and it was a fair price.
Yes, and in fact, it's been calculated that if the Indians had taken the price that they paid and invested it at, say, 5% interest, they would be immensely wealthy today.
That's interesting. Okay, now you had mentioned earlier that Jamestown also had a foray into socialism, and that predates the Pilgrims. In fact, the Pilgrims even came to America because of the permanency of the Jamestown settlement, which began in 1607. Tell us about Jamestown and socialism.
Well, Jamestown was similarly financed by a group of London adventurers, not the same group, but they had imposed the same condition on Jamestown. Now, Jamestown had a few other problems, too, and that's that They were located kind of on a point or almost like a peninsula. There was a reason for this, so they could keep lookout for Spanish or for French warships and so on, but also so that they'd have a point of defense against Indian attack from inland. So they had some reason for that, but it was a swampy area, it was mosquito-laden, it was disease-ridden and so on, not productive land as well. And so Jamestown, they had a worse attrition rate in the first several years than Plymouth did. Nearly 90% of them died. But they were forced into that same communal experiment. I don't remember exactly when they finally shook that off, but that was part of the reason for their disaster as well.
I think you once said to me in a previous interview years and years ago, you said that to be sentenced to forced to go to Jamestown was like a death sentence in many, many cases, at least in those early years, until God in his providence sent a ship laden with goods from England, and the starving people were able to eat and live on.
Well, that is correct. And in fact, after Jamestown had gotten over some of its initial impoverishment, the Jamestown settlement even sent a ship of supplies up to Plymouth to help the Plymouth people.
Wow.
They learned from their experiment.
Isn't that interesting that socialism leads to poverty, and yet socialism is sold as a means to get out of poverty? You know, the problem here, says Mondami, that, living in New York City at this time for so many millions of people, it's unaffordable. So vote for me and we're going to make things affordable. And both in the Plymouth and in the Jamestown examples, well, that didn't work. Didn't work in the Soviet Union, didn't work in China, didn't work in Pol Pot's Cambodia. It didn't work in Fidel Castro's Cuba, and it didn't work in Venezuela. But maybe it'll work this time.
Well, I kind of like what R.G. Rushdie once said, that the average American voter has a political memory that goes back about 30 days. If that's Rushdie's law, I'll have to give you Eisenman's corollary, and that's that Rushdie was an incurable optimist. I'd say he overestimated that by about 3 weeks. And it seems like we forget the lessons of history so quickly, and for some reason we think we are different from previous generations, and where they failed, we will succeed. Well, we'll succeed only if we follow God's principles. And the Jamestown people didn't, and so they failed at first, and once they got back in line with the laws, moral and divine, as the laws of Lord Delaware, when he brought in his legal code from England to the Jamestown settlers, that things really improved. And the same was true there in Plymouth, that once they shook off this idea of man socialism and adopted principles of godly economics, things worked out well. And we need to take that lesson today.
One of the Ten Commandments, of course, going beyond thou shalt not steal, is thou shalt not covet. Does coveting play a role at all in socialism? And by the way, John, just so you know, we have about 1 minute left of this discussion. Coveting.
Absolutely, it does, because coveting is what leads to theft. And the coveting commandment is there as a hedge. It's there to train people. People who are going to covet are going to steal. People who covet their neighbor's wives are going to commit adultery with them. If we train people not to covet, people will be better citizens and respectful of other people's property than if we don't. And that's just a lesson we need to learn. And the Ten Commandments are such a great code for living, but they also point us, because of our many failures, to the cross, because we need the cross for forgiveness for when we fail, as we all do.
All right. Well, we're basically out of time. I can have enough time to give your website, which is morallaw.org, and John Eidsmoes, who's we've been talking with. Again, his classic book is Christianity and the Constitution. John, thanks so much for being with us. All the best.
And thank you, Jerry. Good to talk with you.